Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sine Yanoğlu. I studied neuroscience and then bioengineering, graduating with a PhD from ETH Zurich in Switzerland. Currently, I'm working in the diagnostics industry. Today, I have with me Alison Calder to talk about Synaptic, her new collection of poems. In her new collection, Alison, an award-winning poet, attempts to map the brain's neural connections, raising fundamental questions about identity and interiority. This intricate yearning work from Alison asks us to think about the way we perceive and the ways in which we seek to know ourselves and others. In the book, each section explores key themes in science, neurology, and perception. The first, connectomics, riffs on scientific language to work with and against that language's intentions. Attempting to map the brain's neural connections, it raises fundamental questions about interiority and the self. The lyric considerations in these poems are juxtaposed against the scientific-like footnotes, which, in turn, invoke questions undermining authority and power. The second section, Other Disasters, explores ways of seeing or being seen, from considerations of folklore to modern art to daily life. Alison Calder earned a PhD in English Literature from the University of Western Ontario, following a BA from the University of Saskatchewan and MA from the University of Western Ontario. Calder's debut collection of poetry, Wolf Tree, was a finalist for the Pat Lowther Memorial Award for the Best Book of Poetry by a Canadian Woman in 2008, a finalist for the Gerald Lampert Memorial Award for the Best First Book of Poetry by a Canadian, and winner of the Aquabooks Lanzone Poetry Prize at the Manitoba Writing and Publishing Awards. Calder was awarded the Bronwyn Wallace Award in 2004. Calder is currently a professor in the English department of the University of Manitoba. She lives in Winnipeg with her husband, Warren Carew. Thank you, Alison, for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very much looking forward to our conversation.
Besides the name of the university where you got your BA, I hope I got everything else correctly.
That sounded perfect to me.
Sorry about that. So, I mean, this is your resume, basically, but you were a poet after all, and you're also a critic and a professor. So maybe you want to tell us a little bit about your process, how you come to write poetry, what does it mean for you?
Oh, that's a good question. It's a big question. I think I came to write poetry. My parents were both very interested in literature when we were children. My father actually is an English professor as well, or was until his retirement. So books and poetry were seen as something that were not strange or absurd. I really liked it. I think I really liked the sound of words a lot. And I like things that are kind of strange, I guess. And language is very, very strange, right? And especially if you speak more than one language, you will know, like, intimately, like, the weirdnesses of each way of speaking, right? And so I'm fascinated, I guess, by the way that language lives in particular places. And I don't mean just different languages like, you know, English and German, for example, but the language of sports, right? Or the language of knitting, you know, or the language of science, right? And the ways in which those particular ecosystems, I guess, operate. And, you know, I think we all know how difficult it is to express ourselves in words. And I think, you know, there's always this, you know, this desire to get to that perfect expression that we're going to find. And I think we're never really going to get to that place of perfect expression or perfect knowledge. And that's actually something that I talk about in this particular collection, Synaptic, about, you know, using sort of science as my environment there. But I think, I mean, poetry is something that has always been interesting to me, and I'm fortunate to have found a career, I guess, which allows me to, you know, spend my time reading poetry, talking about it with people, you know, and bouncing ideas off of other people in a way that's not seen as really strange, I guess, because everybody in the world is equally strange to me in my little environment here.
Thank you for that. And actually, in the book, you've already touched upon it a little bit, really, this interplay between scientific language and what that means, because basically science just explains things that we are experiencing very naturally ourselves. So that interplay is really coming across, and I personally really enjoyed reading it. So I want to ask, so there are these two parts about connectomics. How did you come up with the idea to explore that scientific language and specifically neuroscience?
Yeah, well, I have no scientific background, you know, other than a sort of an interested layperson's understanding of general science. But I was in conversation one day with a colleague in the biology department. We were killing time at a meeting, I think, and he mentioned that they have these glowing mice in the biology building. I thought, glowing mice, like, tell me more. So, of course, he's pulled out his phone and we're Googling images and this kind of thing. And I'm like, wow, like, you know, as someone not in that environment, it seems very science fiction to me, you know? And so then he said, you know, if you think that's amazing, you should check out this transparent brain. And I'm like, what? You know, the transparent brain, how can such a thing be? You know, it's so not something I would ever think is even possible, but of course it is. And to many people, like, who work in that field, it's completely normal, right? But for me, it was a strange and weird thing. So I was Googling around images of the transparent brain, and I was really struck by one in particular. And it's an image of a brain that, so it's sort of like a split image, right? And one part of the image is a mouse brain, I think it is, sitting on a page, like, of text, and you can see the little brain there. And the other half of it is that same page, which you can read completely clearly, like, the brain has been turned transparent and you can actually read the text through it. And the intention here is to show how clear you can see everything, right? How everything can be very easily surveyed. But when you get to that text, right, that text is going to trip you up, in my opinion, right? Because what the text actually says is, underneath the brain, I was checking this out this morning just to make sure I got it right. The text says, the brain is a world consisting of a number of unexplored continents and great stretches of unknown territory. Well, that's a metaphor, right? So metaphors are not, like, you're never getting to the thing itself, right? A metaphor or a simile or any kind of poetic comparison, figurative language, really is about deferring meaning, right? Where we can't actually talk about what love is like. So we say love is like a rose, which approximates that, but we never actually get there. So the idea of, like, having this sort of, like, transparent kind of, like, perfect knowledge of something was really challenged by the fact that when you got to the heart of what was being sought, right, it remained this closed box, right? There was something else that could never actually be opened up. So I was really, like, sort of entranced, I guess, by this simultaneous transparency and opacity. Right. And, like, sort of thinking, like, huh, like, this is the, like, this image exists to show that we know, that we know, period. Right. And what it exists, like, what it actually does for me is it shows that we don't know. Right. We haven't reached there. We haven't gotten there yet. So I was really, I guess that was sort of the germ for the idea of exploring ideas about, you know, knowability and power and surveillance and identity. Right. Because the whole idea behind the brain being transparent, I mean, that was, you know, I saw that as a literal thing, but for me, that's also very, again, it's very metaphorical, right? And it speaks to the idea of being able to know who you are. And this is really fascinating, right? Because, you know, I like to believe, like most people, I think that, you know, I'm a creature of my conscious will. You know, I am who I am because it's some sort of innate personality to me, right? But at the same time, if I get a knock on the head, for example, you know, I might, you know, start off being a person who really loves desserts. And after that knock on the head, I'm somebody who, like, has no sweet tooth whatsoever. So, like, how can that be at the same time? You know, so I think I write about things that I'm really interested in exploring. Like, I don't write to answer questions necessarily. Like, I sort of write into questions and see where I get to. And I think this is actually one of the challenges that scientists have as well, right? Where the question is, you know, what do you do with, well, I guess the question would be like, what do you do with failure? Like, or what do you do with the failed experiment? You know, in like the systems, a university system where I work in, failure is not rewarded, for example. Like, if you fail, like, you're not allowed to fail pretty much, or there will be, you know, consequences to various kinds, right? But of course, failure is all around us. And language is always this failure, right? You never get to the thing itself. You never get to what you're saying. And so I was just really interested in all these sort of cross currents, right? And the ways I saw them swirling around with this image of the transparent brain sort of being like the catalyst, I guess, scientific language there, like the catalyst, right, for moving into this project further. And the more I went into it, like the more I was sort of entranced, right, because I was trying to learn about things, but not being a scientist, I'm not reading scientific texts, you know, I'm not reading scientific material. So the only way I as a layperson can understand really is through the use of figurative language, right? Is through comparison and through metaphor and simile. So I was fascinated by the ways that like science was trying to explain itself to the world, right? Using these techniques, and found that very productive as a source of ideas for just sort of riffing off of these different ideas and sort of like saying, okay, like, you know, this word is really interesting. Let's press on that a little bit, right? And see what else, what other meanings come out there, or what other resonances this kind of language has, right? Because, you know, I think one of the goals of the writers that I was reading, trying to explain science, right, was to be very direct and very like straightforward and not go down these like, you know, they wanted to tell me one thing, but I think you can never really say one thing only. You're always going to be pushed in these different directions. So that was what I was trying to do, right? Was sort of look at the language and then see where that was taking me.
Yeah, and that I could, somebody who has actually done research in neuroscience and read quite a lot of papers, it was very nice to see like certain notions where I don't even think a second time what else it might mean being dissected actually in the poems, and like, yeah, but actually it is also like this. I was like, yeah, okay. So just actually so that our readers could also get a bit of a glimpse of your poems, maybe you can read Clarity for us, because now we have actually discussed it quite a lot.
Sure. So the way the poem is set up, now one of the challenges I had as writing these poems was trying to convey information to the reader, right? Because unfortunately, like, not everybody studies neuroscience, right? So not everybody has the sort of context for it. So the question is, you know, how are you going to actually tell people what they need to know in order to understand the poem? And many poems you can build that context in, but not so much these ones. So each of these poems is accompanied by a footnote. And so this, the whole footnoting formatting, which maybe we can talk about a little bit later on, serves two purposes, one of which is sort of theoretical, I guess, like I'm trying to do something with it, and one of which is just basically informative to tell the reader what's going on. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the title of the poem, and then I'm going to read the footnote, and then I'll go back and read the body of the poem. And so we can see how that works. So this is a very short one. It's called Clarity. And the footnote says, "Clarity is the name of the process by which the brain is made transparent. Splicing firefly genes into mice makes neural mapping easier because parts of the brain will fluoresce. These mice are particularly used for Alzheimer's research." Now the poem, Clarity. "Firefly mouse flickers, forgets lessons, forgets want. Inside his skull, the past incinerates, embers blizzarding into ash. The screened brain's amaze, sizzling, fragments of a film that's not replayed. What and how and why flash briefly, die. Mouse mind flares, it turns to glass."
Thank you. I mean, I find it really beautiful because exactly, so we work, and this also these fluorescent proteins, this as you said, this glimmering you know mice, it's so by now so ubiquitous in science that you don't even actually think the beauty of it. So I mean, I was really fascinated with this poem, really kind of getting into that beauty, but also what we are seeing. So you mentioned also, at least that's how I interpreted the past and so on. So all these, for example, memory formation, how these are basically the processes that neuroscientists are studying and seeing, for example, fluorescent protein lighting up, a synaptic connection happening and so on. So knowing these on one side and then having this, you know, beautifully translated in this language and like pulled apart, this was really very, very fascinating to see from my side.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. I mean, obviously, well, maybe it's not obvious, but I mean, the ideas of memory and so on are coming out of the fact that the mice are used for Alzheimer's research. And we can see, I guess, like the kind of range of meanings, I guess, like when I'm talking about the brain being a maze, right, I'm talking about like the way the brain looks, for one thing, like when it's got those little sort of ridges in it and squiggles, it looks like a labyrinth, right? We're talking about mice running through mazes, we're talking about being amazed, like being straight, you know, being spellbound by something, all of these things coming through at the same time. And so I really like the way in which those ideas, like they butt up against each other, I guess, like all those definitions sort of work together and against each other at the same time, right? They all have to exist at the, in the same moment.
And how did you go about, so did you work with some other scientists or did you just do some self-study? Because I have to say, really, the explanations, these footnotes that you mentioned is really actually quite actually concise, but at the same time comprehensive, like it's enough that we understand exactly the scientific concept. So I when I was reading, I thought you must have done quite a lot of work behind that.
Well, the research that I did was largely just Googling, frankly. Like I was, I mean, I think in a sense, like one reason I'm able to sort of be fairly concise in the footnotes is because I don't actually know very much. Like basically the footnote is telling you every single thing that I know about that topic. So it's not like I'm trying to condense this like vast range of like subtleties, right? So I guess really all I'm telling you is like what I find crucial for understanding the poem. And so, I mean, there may be an error or two in the footnotes that I have noticed over time, but so far no one else has pointed them out. So I've been lucky that way. But yeah, I just think it's really, it was really fun research and it really allowed me to follow a lot of strange, random, like rabbit holes and links and just be struck by, like just the imaginative, or what seemed to me, right, a very imaginative ways of conceptualizing the world. Whereas in the discipline of neuroscience, of course, it might be completely like take it for granted and pedestrian, and something else, which I take for granted, would be completely like, you know, entrancing and amazing. But it was very fun learning a different language, kind of in a way, I think, or getting a very basic understanding of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
And I want to touch upon the point you mentioned earlier about transparency and opacity. This to me is like, I can totally, especially neuroscience is such a difficult field to do research in because it's so hard. Like all these tools that you mentioned, the clarifying the brain and fluorescent proteins and so on, these are all tools so that, you know, we could study this actually much easier, but the more you develop tools, it feels like the more challenges still hit you. So I really actually, when you were talking about it, so that you think you know, you use one tool, you think you know, you figure it out, you could answer one question, comes yet another challenge that makes the whole brain or whatever processes you're studying completely opaque. So in that sense, I mean, what you mentioned is with language, this really also interplays with the scientific field itself.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things I was thinking about when I was writing the poems was I was thinking about the display of knowledge as well. And I talk about this in one of the poems as well, the fact that like the brain's all crunched up, right? Like it's this very dense, intense little layered cake kind of. And you can't, like the only way you can actually look at it is to kind of open it out, right? And spread it out so that it's sort of fundamentally altered from what it was. So you might be able to see things a little more easily because all the creases are kind of unfolded. But at the same time, I think you might lose some of that simultaneity, I guess, or sort of like the way I imagine it anyway, is like the brain works as something which is crunched together. It has to be crunched together in order to work, right? Spreading it out, you know, is going to make it not work so much. And actually, I find that to be very much like the way a poem works. Because poems, like especially figurative language, like metaphors and similes, they have all kinds of connotations, I guess, all of which happen at the same time. Or you think of how a pun works, right? Where a word that means like two different things at the same time. In a poem, when you're using a pun or word that have more than one meaning, both of those meanings are operating at the same time. And I find, as someone who teaches poetry, both to creative writing students and also just to, you know, regular students of literature, when I have to dissect that poem, right, I have to flatten it out, right? And so I have to pull those different meanings out and say, like, you know, okay, like, when I say it's like a rose, I mean this, and I also mean this, and I also mean this. And I turn things into a sequence, I guess, rather than actually having them happen all at the same time, which is what happens in the poem. And so I think that's like an interesting challenge that I hadn't thought about before, sort of a similarity between like scientific inquiry and literature. But that was something that struck me as I was doing the thinking about this.
Yeah, I totally see that. I mean, what you're describing also, it's, I can, like, one way of seeing it, I mean, there would be so many analogies, but one way of seeing it would be difference between consciousness, you know, you need the brain exactly to be intact, as you said, and neuroanatomy. You dissect and then you understand this region looks like this, it was previously connected to that, and so on. And these two are, as the both field experts will tell you, are completely different in what you're looking at and how you're studying it. So of course they're interlinked, because one describes the substance and the other is like what's generated from that. But to our, as you said, something what a poem gives to a reader like me, for example, is different than when we go into a class and dissect it and then it becomes something else.
Yeah, very much so. And I think like we have to have both of those things, obviously, but things are lost, I guess, on both sides when these processes are enacted, I guess.
Yeah. And then I want to also touch upon something you've mentioned earlier about academic. So I read academic fields, the failure not being rewarded. This is something also you even, as far as I can interpret, cover in one of the poems as well. So I really actually, I was very happy to see that. So file drawer problem is the poem. So can you talk a little bit about what file drawer problem is, and how did you get inspired to actually talk about this in this poem?
Sure. Well, I'm going to, maybe I'll read that poem if I can just
please
dig it up here. Where did I put that? There it is. So I guess actually the file drawer problem is explained by the footnote. So maybe what I'll do is I will read the footnote and then I'll talk about it a little bit and then I'll read the poem. So the footnote says, the term file drawer problem is shorthand for positive results bias, a type of publication bias that skews researchers into reporting only research that has positive results. Authors are more likely to submit, editors more likely to accept, and granting agencies more likely to fund reports of positive outcomes than those with negative or inconclusive results. And then what you also need to know from the poem is that the main sources of research funding in Canada are three separate research councils, okay, which apply to different broad disciplines there. So, yeah, like I think, one of the challenges that scientists working in at my university, at least, and I imagine others as well, face is the difference between like basic science and I guess applied science, right? So, you know, can you do something, you know, that is just sort of to generate knowledge, sort of this kind of curiosity based knowledge, you know, or must you always make something that can be commodified, you know, or something that can have an immediate use, right? And usually I'm talking about it in terms of commodification, because that's what my institution wants to do with everything, right, is commodify it all. And so there's a real difficulty with I think being able to be as creative perhaps as one might like to do. And I think like one of the commonalities between creative writers and between scientists, right, is this need to like explore things. Like both of them also have to like really work really hard, right, in order to get things done. But also like just try to explore things. And then what happens if, you know, your exploration comes up and you discover like, well, no, this is a dead end, right? Or actually, this was not as productive as I thought it was going to be. Or, you know, I had this ambition to create this structure and it actually just didn't work. Like that is super interesting. Like that's very, very important as well. Right. But what do you do like with the idea of failure or like the idea of, you know, that's not even failure, but just the different results or the result that tells you something other than what you were anticipating it would tell you, you know, what do you do with that? So, I don't think we are reward, like the system, like capital S system, the institution, right, wants us to produce things. Like it wants to make us marketable in different kinds of ways. And so there's, you know, where is the space for the thing that is not marketable? Like what's the price on the priceless kind of thing? So anyway, I'll just read the poem and that will probably tell you, probably what I just did, only probably in a more concise and interesting way. So the poem is File Drawer Problem. Think outside the box, but then you'd better crawl back in. Blue sky thinking only leads to clouds. A man's reach should exceed his grasp. Just kidding. No one likes a loser. Let's optimize and synchronize out of step rockets kicked to the curb. Our metrics don't measure failure, so step on solid ground. Climbing without a rope won't get you anywhere. Stay in harness. Holes in the floor? Keep walking. Eyes on the prize. Try Council Cerberus barking at the door.
Thank you for that. I mean, I was really laughing out loud when you were saying nobody likes a loser. So this is really also, as far as I have experience in academia, it is true that these negative results or what doesn't fit into a very nice hypothesis that is, as you say, marketable, gets just put away. And I always was saying that I don't know how many PhD students' lives were wasted because they didn't know about these negative results and they didn't have to repeat it themselves again and again, I don't know how many times, and pursue it. If this was shared and was available, then, you know, it would advance some thinking in this time, and all this actually also money invested in science could be better used.
Yeah. I mean, there's like, in a sense, I think we're in danger of losing the sort of experimental part of experiments. And obviously that's crucial. You have to be able to try something new that you actually don't know the result of. And again, this goes into the idea of like, you know, do we know things or do we not know things, right? Are we going to find certainty or are we not going to find certainty, right? And there has to be a place for uncertainty because we don't know everything and we're never going to know everything. So we just have to sort of cope with that in some kind of way.
Yeah. And then actually this to me, so don't think because I'm more into neuroscience, I forgot the second part of the collection. This to me very nicely connects with another poem in the second section, which was about a meeting you had actually in the university. So university bulletin.
Oh, University Bolton. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, also for the listeners, so there are, let's say, at least for me, there are certain, you know, when you look at it to the two sections, it could be completely different. You can say, okay, like one is about neuroscience and, you know, there's so many other themes in the second one, but it is also, I saw, let's say, in some poems, some parallels, and in the end, it's also about language and it's also about, you know, self-reflection and this, you know, let's say, what we discussed about like feelings against structure and so on. So, I also thought that this poem, University Bulletin, what you have been talking about just now, about things not being marketable, about, you know, if something doesn't make money, what is the point? I guess there I saw a criticism from you about the university business model right now as basically seeing the student as a source of cash. And, you know, universities are actually not built for that.
Exactly. I'm very involved in my own faculty union here at the University of Manitoba. And so, we just had a 35-day strike. So we're quite thinking about the ways in which the institutional reshaping, I guess, is taking place in ways that are anti-academic. Actually, they're anti-intellectual, and they're anti-scholarship, and they're anti-scholar. And you know, this is very alarming, and this is happening all over the world, right? It's not just in my university; it's like all across Europe, Australia. There are all kinds of threats to the autonomy of the creator, in a sense, I guess, and whether that's like a scientific creator, or whether that's like a literary creator or whatever. Like, I think there's, we're trying to be, turned into tools, I guess, for someone else's ends rather than like knowledge itself being sort of the end. But yeah, but thinking about like the two parts of the book. So the first part of the book is a series of approximately 30 or so poems, which are sort of based on neuroscience and scientific. And the second half is more eclectic. And they're more sort of traditional lyric poems, I guess, right? Where there's a speaker, observing various things about the world and so on. But I think, there's still a lot about power, right? And about knowledge and about, the idea of being thinking you know one thing and then having that blown apart by something else. Like the final poem in the book is about a visit to a shrine, right, to a very important site of Catholic pilgrimage in New Mexico, and the speaker, who is and is not me, right, at the same time, right, like goes there like with this sort of very blasé attitude, is like, well, I know it all, like look at these primitive people with their sacrifices, this is ridiculous, who would ever think this could possibly work? But then like something really profound happens to them, right, and it's not they're not having some sort of religious conversion, right? Or maybe they are, right? Like, who knows what it is, right? It's about uncertainty, right? But they have this sort of overwhelming moment there, which takes them by surprise and which undermines like that which they thought they knew, right, about themselves and about the world and sort of the way things are. So I think that kind of having the rug pulled out from under you is in both of those sections. I think maybe in the first half, I'm trying a little bit more to pull the rug out, like consciously, like to show like, you think you're going to know everything, but you ain't, you're not. Whereas in the second half, it's more the speaker of the poems who is like getting sort of like repositioned in a way. But yeah, I do see them. I said at one point that I thought like the first part was the head and the second part is the heart, but that's wrong. Like they're both each of those things.
Yeah. I would at least to me that completely both being head and the heart completely transported to me while reading the book, the collection. And I mean, with the when you mentioned the pulling the rug, I totally had that. It was a great punch in Foundling 1 and 2. So this was the second section. So maybe, I mean, you can mention about, tell us about a little bit of the theme. I mean, this is, I really like this pointed to a gender discrimination I never thought of. So this would be really great if you can talk about this poem or two poems.
Sure. Well, so yes, I'd love to do that. So a couple of the, several poems in here deal with folklore of different kinds. And actually that comes up also in the first section as well, right? Some of the neuroscience poems have to deal with fairy tales. That idea comes up again in the second part. And so for this particular poem, Foundling, we were traveling, I was doing some research on Hudson's Bay Company workers actually who came from Orkney. So we were in the Orkney Islands there touring around and listening to stories of shipwrecks and this sort of thing. And so shipwrecks and seashores and things like this come up quite a bit in the second part of the book as well. And so I was struck by this sort of, mythical tale, of the shipwreck where the baby is saved. And then I was thinking, like, what would it be like to be that baby? Like, you would never know anything about yourself. But wouldn't you always sort of wonder, like, why was I saved? Like, how come everybody else on that ship, why me? So that was the first part of the poem. And the second part of it is a little bit different. Actually, maybe I'll just read those if I can take a second
to
do that.
Please.
Okay. So you can hear, I guess, the two parts. And right. So there's no footnote for this one. I'll just start there. Foundling. Another story. Night, a ship driven onto rock. Among the breaking timbers, heaving surge of water's giant fist, a strobing flash of lightning shows one thing that can be saved. Small package passed from desperate hand to hand. A baby. Nothing else. Anonymous parcel with no return address. Landless, nameless, face recalling features of the dead. Unmoored. That baby could be anything, from bastard prince to king. Foundling, jettisoned into a future. Who will take him in? Shepherd boy or merchant, he'll sleep with animals or else on feather beds. He'll be written on or write. This story is an anchor he'll drag throughout his life, a sack he can't unpack or drop. A course between Scylla and Charybdis, one cliff the weight of fate, his rescue proof he's marked for something. The power to do good or else destroy, by accident, everything he's come to love around him, moving the story forward, protagonist. Or the other cliff, the certainty of randomness, the knowledge that he doesn't matter, never did. Foundling 2. And if the baby is a girl, that story never starts. And that's the end of that poem.
So thank you for reading Foundling. While reading it, also I completely felt the punch of that second part. So, and also made me think again. This is exactly how it happens in such stories. So you basically then came up with that, as you explained, when you were thinking, okay, like this is what happens if you were this little baby. But then how did you then arrive to the part where you say, oh, what if it was a girl?
Well, I guess maybe I'm always sort of wondering, what if it was a girl?
Yes, that's, I think, always a good question. You have to flip it to see actually if it holds.
Yeah. But I was thinking, I mean, like the reason that this folklore is passed along is because of a family name, right? There's one particular family name in this area, which sounds like it comes from Spain or Portugal. And so that's a hereditary through the male line, right? So we don't have, I mean, I guess, suppose practically speaking, you know, were it a girl who was born, you know, her name would be gone. But then like, how could the baby have a name anyway? This is also another thing. Like these things don't necessarily, you know, make any sense really logically. But I think like the question of what if is always really sort of interesting. Like what if it was a girl? What if it was a kangaroo? You know, what if a nematode could talk? You know, like what would it have to say to us? And thinking about that kind of thing really opens interesting doors, I think. And again, like I would say science, one of its questions should be like, what if, you know? And it's important that we have like all those what ifs as possibilities, that we're not trying to shut it down and be like, you can say what if, but you can only say what if in 10% of, you know, the spectrum of possible what if questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, then I also can understand from this, you're also kind of then have questions about the bias. So, I mean, about gender bias as well. And I can see, so in the second part, there are also poems about aging, about global warming. So what busies Alison's mind as a poet and as a person? I assume this is what we see. So, but what is in your mind? What is what are the concerns that we can see reflected in your poetry here?
Well, I think it's like generally, I guess I would say concerns with power. Specifically, I would say like the ways in which human beings seek to dominate each other and the world, I guess, are larger ones. And specifically, like I have very gendered concerns. I am concerned about the environment. I'm not an activist in those causes particularly. And like I have, you know, friends and colleagues who are out there, you know, putting their lives on the line, I guess, in ways that I do not do that in a, I mean, I'm in the university, I make a good living, you know, I'm a middle-class white woman, straight, cis, like it's all, like I have all this privilege, right? But I think it behooves like a poet's job, I think, is to direct people's attention to things and to say like, hey, look at this. like, look at this thing you never looked at before. I'm going to write a poem about this acorn, you know, and like, then next time you see an acorn, you will maybe think about it a little bit differently. Or, you know, the Canadian poet Aaron Murray has a poem about an onion, right? Which I don't actually really understand that poem very much, but I think it's very beautiful linguistically. But every time I'm chopping onions, right, I sort of have this flash of like thinking about like, oh, like this onion is more than what I think it is. You know, it's not just this object for me to consume, right? There is something else. Possibly there, like this onion consciousness or the onion being or whatever, you know. So I think like poetry and writing, creative writing in general, often tells, like, tries to get people to look at things. And I think my poetry obviously is directive to a certain extent, in which I'm not overtly, I guess, well, maybe I am. Maybe I'm not a good judge of that, but I'm not overtly like trying to tell you what to think about something. But I am telling you to think about it, I guess, ideally. So I would say that would be a concern of mine. I've written poems about my own neighborhood, talking about changes in it, the gentrification and so on that's going on in it, which I'm part of as well. I think these are all just things that I'm thinking about, right? And actually, a lot of them are concerns that come out in my academic writing as well. But poetry allows me to say them in a different way, and to say them in a way which is less thesis-driven, I guess, right? Like a scholarly article, you know, you have a start, you have a trajectory, you have to get to the end, right? You want it to be as clear as possible, right? Poetry, I can bring those things up, but I don't have to clarify them. I can allow them to exist in all of their realistic murkiness. And it's a murkiness that other people can sort of look at as well and pick their way through. So it's not me telling them necessarily, like, thus we can see as a result, blah, 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 right? But, you know, I am showing you these things and sort of, I'm sure, suggesting, like, you know, look at things, you know, turn a little bit like left, I guess, from where you were before, and tell me what you see. Yeah.
Thank you for that. So I would like to really thank you again for joining us today. It has been a very nice conversation. And as a last question, what I would like to ask is, what are you working on now? What can we expect from you as a next project? I know it's mean because there's just this collection of poems are out, but I'm really curious, what's next for you?
Well, I'm curious too, actually.
Good.
I always feel like I have a bit of a hangover after I finish sort of a project, right? Where I feel like the next few things I write will be still kind of like coming out of this project. And actually working on the Connectomics poems was quite interesting for me because the series built up over a period of years to reach the stage that it's at now. And so I'm wondering, you know, like, do I have more to say? Like, I don't think I do, but you know, I might be surprised later on. But it's interesting. Like, I find that as a writer, I'm very influenced by the places that I'm in. So, like, I could be writing a poem about a talking pig in 18th century England, right? Which I have done. But the details in that poem will be what I happen to see out the window. Right. So the pig is looking at flags. I'm looking at flags. The flags go in the poem, you know. So I think what I write in a part depends on where I'm able to go and where I travel to. And now that the world is opening up again a little bit after closing down so much with COVID, I'm not sure what will happen. Actually, I'm looking forward to seeing what's going to bubble up. This collection, Synaptic, was written pre-pandemic. Although I guess a few poems in there were written during the pandemic as part of the revision process. But I'm wondering, you know, post-pandemic, would that change my writing? You know, would there be something different? And I think lots of people are wondering how things are going to change. And this is sort of one of the things specifically that I'm wondering as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to it personally. Thank you, Alison, for joining us today and this great collection of poems.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.